Give her my best,
her father said. He ate his last bite of the egg.
Do you know how few people can cook a perfect egg?
Yes, because you tell me at least twice a week. I have to go or I'll miss the bus. She circled the table and leaned down to kiss his cheek, breathing in the familiar smell of starch from his uniform shirt and bay rum from his aftershave. Ren thought that if she ever wound up in a coma, all the doctors would have to do was wave that combination of scents under her nose, and surely she would wake. She stood up and reached for her knapsack on the counter, but before she could get it, her father grabbed her arm.
What aren't you telling me?
He asked, narrowing his eyes. She forced herself to meet his eyes. What?
Come on, I'm a detective.
Ren danced away from him. I have no idea what you're talking about, she said. Her father shook his head, smiling.
Never let it be said I spoiled a birthday surprise.
Ren walked halfway to the bus stop at the end of the street before she let out the breath she was holding. How had he known? She wasn't hiding a birthday surprise. She was going to get birth control today at the center. She was cutting health class to do it, which felt somehow karmic. Ren thought of how she and Ryan had talked about this, whether it made sense to use condoms, if their safety rate was good enough, how if Ren got contraception, she would do it without having to tell her father. That much she and Ryan agreed upon. Ryan didn't relish the thought of her detective father with his standard issue Glock, finding out that his daughter was sleeping with him. Ren knew there were girls who were so unromantic they had sex because they wanted to get it over with. There were others who were so starry-eyed, they truly believed that the guy they had sex with the first time would be their one and only. Ren was caught somewhere on the spectrum between the two. She wanted to have sex for the first time with someone she could laugh with, if things got weird or didn't work. But she also knew there was more to it than that. She knew your first time could only happen once. There were so many memories that you didn't get to pick, like being the only kid in her class who wrote a Mother's Day card to her aunt, or turning 70 shades of red when she had to explain to her father that the reason she'd called him from the nurse's office wasn't that she had the flu, but that she had gotten her period. Given that, shouldn't you get to choose this memory and make it perfect? The bus pulled up to the curb, exhaling heavily as its doors swung open. She picked her way through the rows, past the jocks and the brains and the theater nerds, and slid into a blessedly empty row. She pressed her cheek to the cool glass. The next time she rode this bus, she would be taking the pill. She wondered how many other girls on the bus were. She wondered who was having sex, if they all felt as swollen with that secret as she did. One day she would tell her father that she wasn't a virgin, like when she was married and 30 and having a baby. As the bus chugged toward the school, Ren thought maybe this was a birthday gift to her father after all. He got to think she belonged only to him. For a little while longer. Hugh was 40, and he felt every fucking minute of it. He flattened his hands on the table, bracketing the plate of breakfast Ren had made him, which he had scraped clean. You'd think that things would be different, that there would be an invisible line between yesterday and today to mark the fact that he was this old, but no. He was still headed to the same precinct he'd been at since he became a cop. He was still a single parent. The table still had one wobbly leg that he hadn't managed to fix. The only new thing was silver in his beard stubble, which frankly, he could have lived without. He supposed that this was the age that men began to wonder if they were doing anything that would leave a mark on the world. If he died today, what would be said at his funeral? Sure, he had made a difference in the lives of individuals, given his career, and he would not have traded a moment of his time with Ren. But he wasn't a genius. He wouldn't invent something that eliminated fossil fuels or allowed for time travel. He'd never negotiate world peace. He supposed if every individual man did his best, then the greater balance tipped toward good rather than evil. But that didn't keep the individual daily chain of one's life from feeling, well, mundane. Plus, damn it, his back hurt after he'd been on his feet all day in a way it never used to. He feared, although he would never admit it to anyone, that this was the crest, the pinnacle, that the rest of his life would be a slow march down the hill, that he had already experienced the best of what was coming to him. What was getting old anyway, except dragging your feet toward the inevitable? He was saved from skating further down this morbid path of thought by the buzzing of his cell phone. Bex's face popped onto the screen and he smiled, shaking his head. "Happy birthday to you," she sang, as soon as he answered. "Happy birthday to you." He let her finish her off-key rendition. "I think I know who Ren gets her dubious singing ability from," he said. "Because it's your birthday," his sister said, "I'm going to let that slide." Hugh scratched his neck. "Tell me, does it go away?"
"What?"
"This feeling that it's the beginning of the end." She laughed. "Hugh, I'd give anything to be 40 again. You must think I have one foot in the grave." She was 14 years his senior, but he never thought of her that way. "You're not old."
"Then neither are you," she said. "What are you doing to mark this festive occasion?"
"Protecting and serving."
"Well, that's depressing. You should be doing something extraordinary, like taking a salsa lesson or going skydiving."
"Yeah," Hugh said. "I don't think so."
"Where's your sense of adventure?"
"Tied to a paycheck," Hugh said. "Today's just like any other day."
"Maybe you'll be wrong," Bex replied. "Maybe today will be unforgettable." He carried his empty plate to the sink, ran water over it, like he did every morning. He grabbed his badge and his car keys.
"Maybe," Hugh said.
Every morning, Janine woke up and said a prayer for the child she didn't have. She knew that there were plenty of people who wouldn't understand, or who would call her a hypocrite. Maybe she was. But to her, that just meant she had something to make up for, and this was how she was going to do it. She padded into the bathroom and brushed her teeth. There were anti-lifers who would rather cut off their arms than change their opinions. But she could try to make people like that understand how she felt. Start with the sentence, "The unborn baby is a person." Replace the words "unborn baby" with the words "immigrant," "African-American," "trans woman," "Jew," "Muslim." That visceral yes that swelled through them when they said that sentence out loud, that was exactly how Janine felt about being pro-life. There were so many organizations set up to combat racism, sexism, homelessness, mental illness, homophobia. Why shouldn't there be one to fight for the tiniest humans, who were the most in need of protection? Janine knew she would never be able to convince everyone to believe what she did. But if she changed the mind of even one pregnant woman, well, wasn't that a start? She reached for the wig that she had propped over the neck of a shampoo bottle last night. Inclining her head, she slipped it on, fitting it tightly against her scalp. Then she looked in the mirror. Janine grinned. She didn't look half bad as a blonde. Olive lay on her side, watching Peg sleep. There was so much she did for her wife that Peg did not acknowledge. The first cup of coffee that was always too bitter, Olive took it. The floor was a mess. Olive vacuumed while Peg went for her morning run. The sheets on the bed that were fresh every Sunday didn't change themselves. Olive had done these things because she loved Peg. But now, she could see into the future. A year from now, Peg would spit out her coffee, wade through tufts of dust bunnies, sleep in sheets that were never washed. Maybe they would smell faintly of Olive. The truth was, for years now, Olive had been unable to imagine a world without Peg in it. Peg was about to have to imagine a world without her. Peg's eyes opened. She saw Olive staring and snuggled closer into her arms.
"What are you thinking about?" she murmured.
Olive felt her throat tightening in the grip of the secret she held, and it felt wrong, unnatural.
"I'm thinking," she said finally, honestly, "about how much I'll miss you."
Peg smiled, closing her eyes.
"And where exactly are you going?"
Olive opened her mouth and then hesitated. She might have to count time, but she didn't need to start the clock yet. She pulled Peg into her arms.
"Absolutely nowhere," she said.
Joy did not remember her dreams as a rule. This came, she was certain, from sleeping with one eye open at foster homes, to make sure that another kid wasn't stealing something that belonged to her, a book, a candy bar, her body. Yet months ago, the night before Joy had taken a pregnancy test, she'd imagined that she had a baby, wrapped in a blue blanket. She'd had the same dream last night. Her alarm had awakened her, another anomaly. Normally, she woke up at least 5 minutes before it went off, but she couldn't be late today, so she had showered quickly, only to realize that her razor was broken. She did not eat, she'd been told not to, and since she was not supposed to drive herself home, she called for an Uber. Her driver had pictures of his children stuck to the dashboard of his Kia.
"You're gonna be a hot one today," he said as they pulled away from the curb, and she silently cursed. She didn't want a chatty driver. She wanted one who was mute, preferably.
"I guess," she said. He glanced into the rearview mirror.
"You in town for the convention?"
She imagined this. What if there was a convention of unhappily pregnant women? What if they filled an entire conference hall? What if there were breakout sessions for self-doubt and stupid choices? Or a sitting area where you could cry, and a soundproof room where you could curse as loud as you wanted at a man, at your rotten luck, at God? What if there was a keynote with a motivational speaker who could truly convince you that tomorrow was going to be better than yesterday? Scratch that. It wasn't the pregnant women who needed a convention to educate them. It was the people who were rushing the gates, telling women like Joy she was going to hell.
"So you're not a dentist?" the driver said.
"What?"
"The convention."
"Oh," Joy said. "No." She had entered the center's address into her Uber app, but now she wanted to get out of the car. She wanted to walk. She needed to be alone. "Can you pull over here?" she asked.
"Everything okay?"
The driver slowed and put on his blinker, rolling to a stop. "Yeah, I just need to... This is great. I got the address wrong," she lied. Never mind that they were literally beside a parking lot with a defunct video store that was boarded up. "It's just around the corner."
"Okay, then," the driver said.
Joy started walking. She felt the sun on the crown of her head. It might have been a blessing. She could hear the car rolling along behind her, slowly crunching the gravel on the side of the road.
"Pass me,"
she thought.
Jesus Christ, leave already.
The Kia pulled up beside her, and the driver rolled down the window. Joy felt like crying. Why today, of all days, did she have to get the Uber guy with a conscience?
Ma'am, he said, you forgot this.
She came closer and saw that he was holding up the blue blanket that had been in two of her dreams. It had not been in the back seat with her. Joy blinked at it. That doesn't belong to me, she said, and she kept going. Izzy was yawning as she drove. She hated night shifts, and she had worked long enough as a nurse in the ER at Baptist Memorial to be able to avoid them. But she had willingly swapped with a colleague, Jayla, because she had to take the next 2 days off. She had already been on the road an hour and a half, and she had another hour left. And she knew this because she had Googled it multiple times, as if the answer might change. But still, rather than leaving Oxford at 6 a.m. as she had intended, when her shift ended, she had taken the elevator up to the birthing pavilion. Nobody had stopped her from going into the nursery. She had her ID clipped right to her scrubs. To her surprise, though, there had been only a single baby. It was a little boy, swaddled in a blue blanket. He had a name card, Levon Monell. One tiny fist had punched the air, and his mouth had been wide open. Izzy had watched him cry and flail around a little bit, and then, through some miracle of guidance, his hand had landed on his lips, and he'd started to suckle. You were never too young to learn to be self-sufficient. She had stroked a finger down the tight, mummied wrap of his little body. Was it dishonest to not tell Parker she was pregnant? Or would it be worse to tell him and then break up with him? Izzy had grown up with her face pressed so hard against reality that it was impossible for her to believe in mythical creatures, fairies and unicorns, and men who cared more about Izzy's future with them than about her past. She had tried to picture herself in Parker's world, learning how to ski and spending $50 at a movie on seats and popcorn and sodas without feeling guilty. But if she became that woman, she wouldn't be Izzy anymore. And wasn't that who he had fallen in love with? It was better this way. Parker would never know. He wouldn't be forced to stay with her out of some misguided sense of honor or chivalry. Once he had space and time to think it over, once he settled down with someone more like him, he would realize she had done him a favor. Someone who had grown up getting by day to day just didn't have the resources to dream about the future. When Izzy had left the little room, she stopped at the nurse's desk. How come there aren't more babies? The nurse had looked at her like she was crazy. They're in the rooms with their mamas. Izzy had felt like an idiot. Of course they were. Even now, as she drove, she wondered about Levon's mother. Had she needed to get a good night's sleep? Was she sick? Was he? Izzy was afraid the answer was also something any vaguely maternal female knew, which was why she hadn't asked the L&D nurse. If she needed confirmation that she was making the right choice, she'd received it. The GPS on her phone told her that in 2 miles, she would be turning right. She put on her signal, following the directions carefully, because she was not familiar with the roads in Jackson, Mississippi. But even with her detour to the nursery, Izzy knew she would be fine. Barring unforeseen traffic, she would reach the center in plenty of time for the first appointment of her abortion. You had to get up ridiculously early in Atlanta to get to Mississippi by 8 a.m. But Louis preferred sleeping in his own bed to sleeping in a hotel. He spent so many days of the month jetting to Kentucky and Alabama and Texas and Mississippi and other states where abortion clinics were being shut down left and right that when he could pull up his own covers and rest his head on his own pillow, he moved heaven and earth to make it happen. He was in Mississippi 4 times a month to provide abortion services, as were 3 other colleagues who rotated coverage, flying in from Chicago and Washington, D.C. Louis had known that working in the Deep South as an abortion provider was more challenging, say, than working on the East Coast. The biggest difference between the North and the South was not the weather or the food or even the people. It was religion. Here, religion was as much of the atmosphere as carbon dioxide. You had to offer folks the chance to be pro-choice, not in spite of their faith, but because of it. Louis liked routine, and he adhered to it whenever possible. He knew the flight attendants by name and always reserved his favorite seat, 6B. He drank coffee, black, and he ate a Kind bar and a yogurt that he packed from home. He used the time on the plane to catch up on medical journal articles. Today he was reading the research of a team from Northwestern University who had recorded a zinc flash at the precise instant a sperm fertilized an egg. A rush of calcium at that moment caused zinc to be released from the egg. As the zinc burst out, it attached itself to small fluorescent molecules, the spark that was picked up by camera microscopes. Although this had been seen before in mice, it was the first time in humans. More important, certain eggs glowed a little brighter than others at the moment of conception, the same ones that went on to become healthy embryos. Given that 50% of eggs fertilized in vitro weren't viable, and that often it came down to a clinician guessing which one looked the healthiest, the implications of the study were significant. The correct embryo to transfer was the one that had burned the brightest at the moment of fertilization.
"Then God said, let there be light," Louis murmured to himself.
He shook his head in wonder. Those infinitesimal bits of zinc determined whether an egg would become a completely new genetic entity. Science never failed to humble him just as much as his faith, and he unequivocally believed that the two could exist side by side. As a resident, he sat with his share of terminal patients, and what you heard was true. People who were dying talked of a tunnel with a warm glow at the end. It stood to reason that both life and death began with a spark of light. Louis was so absorbed in the article that the jolt of the plane hitting the runway startled him. He gathered up his reading material and waited for the seatbelt sign to go off. Then he stood up and pulled his suitcase down from the overhead bin. He traveled only with a carry-on, preferring to keep extra clothes in Vanita's office just in case. He said goodbye to Courtney, the flight attendant, and turned left when he entered the terminal. He knew this airport by rote. When TSA pre-check got busy, at which gate he could find Starbucks, where the men's rooms were. He knew exactly how long it would take for him to get his rental car and drive to the center. And as always, because he was on such a predictable schedule, his welcome committee was waiting for him when he arrived. One of the regular protesters at the clinic met Louis at the airport without fail. Waiting at the base of the stairs near baggage claim, which was the only route to the rental car agencies. Louis liked to think of the dude as Alan the Anti. He held a hand-lettered sign that said, "Louis Ward murders babies." Louis didn't know what pissed him off more, that the man was as regular as clockwork or that he misspelled Louis's name. Alan was standing, as usual, with his sign. Louis never engaged. He knew better. But this time, the sign was spelled right. It was enough to cause Louis to slow his gait. "Dr. Ward," Alan said, smiling. "Good flight." He stopped.
"Is Alan, right?"
Yes, sir, the man said.
Louis glanced at his watch.
What do you say we grab a bite to eat?
He had 15 minutes of slush time because his flight had come in a touch early, and he felt safe in the airport, surrounded by people. Maybe it was possible to walk in another person's shoes without trampling his steps. Alan tucked his sign beneath his arm and they walked back up the stairs to McDonald's, where Louis treated the protester to a big breakfast and coffee, and then sat down across from him at a table in full view of anyone passing by to get to the ticket counter.
Can I ask you why you meet me here? He asked.
Alan swallowed and smiled.
I want to shut down that murder factory you work in, he said, as easily as he might say, it's been a really warm October. Murder factory, Louis repeated, turning the phrase over in his mouth. How long should the women in my care go to jail for their offense? Hate the sin, not the sinner, Alan said. Unless the sinner is me, right?
Louis clarified.
So if you could, you'd ban all abortions? Ideally. Even in cases of rape and incest?
Alan shrugged.
Really, how big a percentage is that? You didn't answer my question,
Louis pressed.
You didn't answer mine, Alan countered. And even if it's one of those rare circumstances, that doesn't mean you're not committing homicide.
Louis thought of the sack he removed during an early abortion. It was tissue that didn't feel pain or have thought or sensation. To him, it was potential. To Alan, it was a person. And yet who would argue that there was no difference in the moral implication of chopping down a 100-year-old oak tree versus stepping on an acorn? Alan took a mouthful of eggs.
Yet another life potential squandered, Louis thought. You know, I consider myself pro-life, he said. I just happen to be pro the life of the woman. I'd call you pro-birth. I'd call you pro-abortion, Alan said. No one is forcing women to have abortions if they don't ask for them. It's the difference between supporting free will and negating free will.
Alan leaned back in his chair.
I don't think you and I are ever going to be on the same page on that. Probably not. But maybe we can agree to neutralize the public space around policy making. We're all entitled to our religious beliefs, right?
Warily, Alan nodded.
But we can't make policies based on religion when religion means different things to different people, which leaves science. The science of reproduction is what it is. Conception is conception. You can decide the ethical value that has for you based on your own relationship with God. But the policies around basic human rights with regard to reproduction shouldn't be up for interpretation.
Louis watched Alan's eyes glaze with confusion.
Do you have a daughter, Alan? I do. How old? 12. What would you do if she got pregnant now?
Alan's face flushed.
Your side always tries to do that. I'm not trying to do anything. I'm asking you to apply your dogma personally. I would counsel her. I would take her to our pastor. And I would be confident, Alan said, that she would make the right choice. I don't disagree with you, Louis said.
Alan blinked.
You don't? No, your religion should help you make the decision if you find yourself in that situation. But the policy should exist for you to have the right to make it in the first place. When you say you can't do something because your religion forbids it, that's a good thing. When you say, I can't do something because your religion forbids it, that's a problem.
Louis glanced at his watch. Duty calls.
You know, it's always funny to me how pro-choice folks were all actually born,
Alan said. Louis grinned, gathering their trash.
Thank you for the company and the dialogue.
Alan picked up his sign.
You make it very hard to hate you, Dr. Ward.
That's the point, brother, Louis said. That's the point.
Beth had tried to do it the right way. She had gone to the center, which might as well have been on Mars, given the distance and the cost of the bus ticket. She had filled out the parental consent waiver and had it filed back in her own county. It wasn't her fault that the judge whiffed out on her to go on a vacation with his wife. Judges shouldn't be allowed to take them, not when other people's lives were hanging on their verdicts. In the end, she had run out of time. The pills had come from overseas, and the instructions were in Chinese. But she still had the paperwork from the counseling session she had attended at the center, including the instructions for those getting a medication abortion. She remembered the lady at the clinic who talked to the group, saying that there was a time cutoff for the people who took the abortion pill. She couldn't remember what that magic number of weeks was, but Beth was sure she was beyond it now. She was in the bathroom, doubled over with cramps. At first, she was sure she had done something wrong, because there hadn't been any blood at all. Now it wouldn't stop. And it wasn't just blood, it was clots, great, dark, thick masses that terrified her. That was why she had come to sit on the toilet. She could reach behind her and flush. She was terrified of looking down between her legs and seeing tiny arms and legs, a sad, minuscule face. She felt her insides twist again, as if someone had attached 1,000 strings to the inside of her belly and groin and yanked them. Beth drew her knees up even higher to her chin, the only thing that brought relief. But to do that, she couldn't sit. She got off the toilet and rolled to her side, sweating, groaning. Her breath shortened, stuttered links on a chain. The thing that slipped between her legs was the size of a clenched fist. Beth cried out, seeing it on the linoleum, pink and unfinished. Its translucent skin showing dark patches of future eyes and organs. Between its legs was a question mark of umbilical cord. Shaking, she grabbed a hand towel and wrapped the thing up. It wasn't a baby. It wasn't a baby. It wasn't a baby. And stuffed it into the bottom of the trash, arranging tissues and makeup wipes and wrappers on top of it, as if out of sight would be out of mind. She was starting to see stars, and she thought maybe she was dying. But that didn't make sense, because there was no way she was going to heaven anymore. Maybe she could just close her eyes for a minute, and when she woke up, this would never have happened. She heard a pounding, and for one terrified moment, she thought it was coming from the trash can. But then it got louder, and she realized someone was calling her name. Beth wanted to answer. She did. But she was so, so tired. When the door broke open, the lock shattered by her father, she used all the energy she had left to speak.
Don't get mad, Daddy,
she whispered. And then everything went black. George left the truck running, parked illegally in a fire zone. He dashed to the passenger side and lifted his unconscious daughter into his arms, carrying her through the automatic doors of the emergency room.
She was bleeding through the blanket he had wrapped around her.
"Please help my daughter,"
he cried, and he was surrounded immediately. They took her away, setting her on a gurney and rushing her into the back as he followed. A nurse put her hand on his arm. "Mr.
Goddard," he said, "that's my girl."
"What happened to her?" she asked.
I don't know, he gulped. "I found her like this in the bathroom. She's bleeding from down there."
"Vaginally?" He nodded. He tried to see what the doctors were doing, but there were so many of them, and they moved around her, blocking his view. "What's your daughter's name?" the nurse asked. When she was little and couldn't pronounce her name, she called herself Lil Bit. That stuck for the longest time. As she grew up, he had dropped the second half of that term of endearment, but he was the only one to call her Lil. Everyone else used a different nickname.
"Elizabeth Goddard," George said. "She goes by Beth."
Last night, Bex had dreamed of a piece of art that was still inside her mind. It was a pixelated fetus, curled on its side, in the white space, though, carved out by the absence of arms and legs and umbilicus. You would see the optical illusion of a profile, and if you looked closely, you'd know it was hers. She was not surprised that today, of all days, she would find inspiration. Just yesterday, she had finished her last commission. It was time to start fresh. She had already called Hugh to wish him a happy birthday, and she had finished a cup of tea. Her body was humming with anticipation, like a child waiting for the sun to rise on Christmas. She was going to savor every second of this morning, pluck it like a violin string, let it sing through her. In the closet of her studio where she kept her paints and her turpentine and her brushes, there was a tiny panel that, with the press of a finger, would bounce free to reveal a hiding spot. It had come with the house. She had no idea what it had been used for by the previous owners, a safe, maybe, or hidden love letters. Bex kept a shoebox inside, one that she pulled out now and set on her workbench. Inside was an impossibly small blue cotton hat and a hospital bracelet, Baby Boy McElroy. And then, best of all, the photograph, fading now, into rusts and yellows and greens that she associated with the 70s. It was 1978, and there was Bex in the hospital bed, 14 years old, and holding a newborn Hugh. Bex could have gotten an abortion. It was legal. But her mother, a devout Catholic, talked her out of it. She came up instead with the solution that became a secret. From the moment Bex left the hospital, she was no longer Hugh's mother, but his sister. Her father got a job in a different state, and they moved there, plastering over the subterfuge, until sometimes Bex even forgot the reality. There had been a point when her mother died that Bex had considered telling Hugh, but she was afraid he might be so angry that he'd hate her. This she couldn't risk. Bex still got to watch Hugh grow up, have a baby of his own. So did the labels really matter? It had taken her 40 years of careful practice, but she allowed herself regrets only one day a year. This one. Hugh's birthday. She took out this shoebox and she pictured the parallel universes of her life. In one, she was Hugh's mother, Ren's grandmother. In another, she had fallen in love again, married and had a child she could gather into her arms anytime she wished. In a third, she went to art school and moved to Florence and became a sculptor, instead of staying in Mississippi to watch over Hugh after her father had died and her mom became an alcoholic. Bex, who had not terminated her pregnancy, had still lost a potential life that day. Her own. But when she started to grieve for what she had missed, she redirected her attention to the lives that had been saved, literally, by her son. The battered wives, the suicide jumpers, the teenager Hugh had pulled from the freezing river last year. Ren? No. She would not have changed a thing. Or this is what she told herself anyway, when she let the question rise high in her throat, when she felt like she was choking. Bex carefully put the photo in the bottom of the shoebox and placed the bracelet and the hat inside. She carried it back to the closet and slipped it into its hiding place. Then she pulled the trap door into place again, sealing the crypt of this memory. Occasionally, she wondered if, after she died, someone would find the shoebox. Maybe whoever bought her house. She wondered if they would create a mythology around the artifacts. If it would be a tragedy or a love story. It could, Bex knew, be both at once. She shut the closet and then opened the curtains in her studio. Sunshine spilled onto the wooden floor, like golden grain from a silo. The sky was clear, as blue as her son's eyes. It was why she had named him as she did, her only hint. Even at 14, Bex had already pictured the world as an artist did, cast in shadows and light. Even then, what mattered most was Hugh. Hugh. Bex smiled, reaching for the stretcher bars and unprimed canvas. Today, she thought, is a good day to be born. Epilogue. 6 p.m. None of us choose our parents, but some of us get lucky. For one perfect moment, Ren felt her father's arm close around her. She could smell him, bay rum aftershave and starch.
It's okay, he whispered,
his breath moving the hair at her temple.
Everything is okay now.
She believed him. She always had. She believed him when he swore to her that there was no reason to be afraid of the dark and taught her how to read the stars so she would never feel lost in it. She believed him when he printed out articles about internet predators and catfishing and left them taped to her bathroom mirror. She believed him when he ate a spider to prove that it wasn't so scary after all. He gently pushed her back, his eyes catching on their clasped hands.
Ren, go on now, he said.
She couldn't make herself step away. Ren, who had gotten herself into this mess because she couldn't wait to grow up, wanted nothing more than for her father to rock her on his lap and never let her go.
Let me finish this, he murmured.
She took an unsteady step toward the white canopy of the tent. There were cops there, motioning to her, but no one came forward to grab her. Once there had been a tornado in Jackson. Ren remembered how the sky turned the yellow of a jaundiced eye and how the atmosphere felt pregnant. The moments before the wind slammed into the city, the air had gone so still that Ren thought the world had stopped spinning, that time had started to move backward. That's how it felt just then, and it was why Ren turned around halfway to the command tent. She heard her father's voice as he spoke to George Goddard.
Think of your daughter. She'll never look at me the same after this. You don't get it. Then make me understand.
Ren was staring at the shooter when he pulled the trigger. Ren's father used to tell her a story about how he'd been her hero from the moment she was born. She was in the hospital and the nurses were doing whatever tests they had to do before a baby could be discharged. One of them was called the Guthrie test, which required the newborn's foot to be pricked and several drops of blood to be dripped onto a diagnostic card. It was sent to the lab to test for PKU. The nurse that day was inexperienced, and when she pricked Ren's foot, the baby started to wail. It didn't bleed enough, so she had to prick Ren a second time. She squeezed the baby's foot, trying to manually extract blood. By now, Ren was howling. Her father stood up and grabbed his daughter away from the nurse. He wrapped Ren in a blanket and announced that they were going home. The nurse said this wasn't possible, that she had to finish the test by law.
"I am the fucking law," her father said.
He still wasn't allowed in that hospital. Heroes, Ren knew, did not always swoop in to rescue. They made questionable calls. They lived with doubts. They replayed and edited and imagined different outcomes. They killed, sometimes, to save. Ren was wrapped in a space blanket, shivering, even though it was still hot outside. Her ribs hurt from where she had been tackled by a member of the SWAT team. Would the gunman actually have shot Ren? No one knew, because instead her father had scooped up his weapon and fired 3 shots into George Goddard. On live television. There had been a lot of activity. Her father being pulled away by the SWAT team, paramedics loading the body into an ambulance because a doctor had to pronounce the shooter dead. The shooter. Ren realized with a little start that title applied to both men. She was sitting on the flatbed of a police truck when her father approached. His arm had gauze wrapped around it. Goddard's wayward shot, the one meant for her, had struck him. She had come to the clinic because she didn't want to be a little girl anymore. But it wasn't having sex that made you a woman. It was having to make decisions, sometimes terrible ones. Children were told what to do. Adults made up their own minds, even when the options tore them apart. Her father followed her gaze to the center. Bathed in the last throes of sunset, the orange walls looked like they were on fire.
"What's going to happen to it?" Ren asked.
"I don't know."
She found herself thinking about Dr. Ward and Izzy and Joy and Janine, about poor Vanita, about the nameless women who had been in the center before Ren got there, and the women who would show up tomorrow for an appointment and trample over the police tape if they had to.
"Aunt Bex is waiting for us," her father said.
He held out his arms as if Ren were still little and swung her down from the flatbed. Ren saw him wince because of his injury. When she was tiny, she used to play a game with him by tightening her arms and legs and straightening her backbone to be as rigid as possible. "I'm making myself extra heavy," she would tell him, and he would laugh.
"I'll always be able to carry you."
The night sky rippled, blue stars rising and red ones fading. They were surrounded by life and death. They moved past the chain-link fence that ran along the perimeter of the center. On it, the protesters had hung a long curl of butcher paper.
"It's a child. Not a choice."
Ren had walked past the sign this morning, and remarkably, it was still intact. A few feet past the center, Ren stopped.
"You all right?" her father asked.
"Just a second."
Ren ran back to the fence. She ripped the banner off, crumpled a long piece, and threw it on the ground. What remained, she speared on the top of the chain link to secure it. "Choice." She surveyed her work.
"There," Ren thought.
Many years later, when Ren told this story, she didn't remember amending the sign. She didn't remember whether the fence outside the center was plaster or metal, how small the closet had been, or if her aunt's blood had spilled on tile or carpet. What she remembered was that as she left with her father, it was the first time she held his hand, instead of the other way around.
Hi, I'm Jodi Picco, and this is the author's note from A Spark of Light. The National Abortion Federation compiles statistics on violence committed by anti-abortion protesters in the United States and Canada. Since 1977, there have been 17 attempted murders, 383 death threats, 153 instances of assault and battery, 13 individuals wounded, 100 stink bombs, 373 break-ins, 42 bombings, 173 arsons, 91 attempted bombings or arsons, 619 bomb threats, 1,630 incidents of trespassing, 1,264 incidents of vandalism, 655 anthrax threats, 3 kidnappings. 11 people have been killed as a result of violence targeted at abortion providers. 4 doctors, 2 clinic employees, a security guard, a police officer, a clinic escort, and 2 others. Anti-abortion extremists are considered a domestic terrorist threat by the U.S. Department of Justice. Yet violence is not the only threat to abortion clinics. In the past 5 years, politicians have passed more than 280 laws restricting access to abortion. In 2016, the Supreme Court struck down a Texas law that would have required every abortion clinic to have a surgical suite and doctors to have admitting privileges at a local hospital in case of complications. For many clinics, these requirements were cost prohibitive and would have forced them to close. Also, since many abortion doctors fly in to do their work, they aren't able to get admitting privileges at local hospitals. It is worth noting that less than 0.3% of women who have an abortion require hospitalization due to complications. In fact, colonoscopies, liposuction, vasectomies, and childbirth, all of which are performed outside of surgical suites, have higher risks of death. In Indiana in 2016, Mike Pence signed a law to ban abortion based on fetal disability and required providers to give information about perinatal hospice, keeping the fetus in utero until it dies of natural causes. This same law required aborted fetuses to be cremated or given a formal burial, even if the mother did not wish this to happen. The law was blocked by a judge in 2017. In Alabama, a 2014 law required a minor to get a judicial waiver for abortion from a court, where a guardian ad litem would be provided as a lawyer for the fetus. In this same law, a parent or legal guardian had the right to appeal the bypass, delaying it until the girl was past the point where she could legally abort. A federal judge struck down this law in 2017. In Arkansas, women must be informed that it is possible to reverse the effects of the medication abortion with progesterone. Similar bills have been introduced in Arizona, Colorado, California, Indiana, Idaho, North Carolina, and Georgia. Americans United for Life, a powerful lobbyist group, made abortion pill reversal part of its model legislation for 2017. However, there are no formal studies that support the claim that a medication abortion can, indeed, be reversed. On March 19, 2018, after this book was submitted to the publisher, Governor Phil Bryant of Mississippi signed into law the Gestational Age Act, banning abortions in Mississippi after 15 weeks of pregnancy, making it the state with the earliest abortion ban in the United States. He tweeted, "I am committed to making Mississippi the safest place in America for an unborn child." The law makes exceptions for severe fetal abnormality, but not rape or incest. Doctors who perform abortions after 15 weeks must file reports explaining why, and if they violate the law, their medical licenses will be endangered. The Jackson Women's Health Organization, the Pink House, is the only abortion provider in Mississippi and already cuts off abortions at 16 weeks. There is no medical or scientific reason for the change. There's a mistaken belief that legislating barriers to pregnancy termination or overturning Roe v. Wade will end abortions. Precedent doesn't suggest this. In the 1950s, up to 1.2 million unsafe abortions were performed annually. According to the Guttmacher Institute, the rate of abortions declined from 2000 through 2008, in spite of their legality. But breaking down the numbers is important. For women in poverty, abortion rates increased 18%. For wealthy women, abortion declined by 24%. That means poor women are getting pregnant when they don't want to. In fact, 7 out of 10 women who terminated a pregnancy made less than $22,000 a year. In 2004, 3/4 of women surveyed said they had an abortion because they couldn't financially care for a child. No study to date has asked if improving socioeconomic conditions for these women would decrease the number of abortions. For this book, I interviewed pro-life advocates. They were not religious zealots. They were men and women whose conversation I enjoyed and who were speaking from a place of deep personal conviction. All of them were appalled by acts of violence committed in the name of unborn children. They told me they wished that pro-choice advocates knew that they weren't trying to circumvent women's rights or tell women what to do with their bodies. They just wanted the women who made that legal choice to realize that life was precious and that their decision would affect an innocent. I also interviewed 151 women who had terminated a pregnancy. Of those women, only one regretted her decision. The majority thought about the abortion daily. When I asked them what they wished pro-life advocates knew about them, the responses were heartfelt. Many wanted to convey that a woman who makes this decision is not a bad person. As one woman said, "I don't need people shaming me because of a choice that already hurt my heart to have to make." I met with the staff at the Pink House. I also had the privilege to shadow Dr. Willie Parker as he performed abortions at the West Alabama Women's Center in Tuscaloosa, Alabama. And yes, the fictional Dr. Ward bears a close resemblance to Willie. Dr. Parker is one of the fiercest champions of women I have ever met, and he is a devout Christian. He chose this work because of his faith, not in spite of it. He feels that the compassion in his religion means he has to act on behalf of others instead of judging them. It is Dr. Parker who invented what he calls verbicane, the conversation meant to relax a patient during the procedure. It is not intended to trivialize what's happening. It's meant to put the event into context. An abortion, he feels, should not be the benchmark by which a woman will measure her entire life. I urge you to read his book, Life's Work, A Moral Argument for Choice, to learn more about his journey. In Birmingham, thanks to the generosity and grace of 3 patients, I observed a 5-week abortion, an 8-week abortion, and a 15-week abortion. The first 2 procedures took less than 5 minutes each, and yes, I saw the products of conception, and there was nothing that would suggest to the naked eye a dead baby. The 15-week procedure was more complicated and took a few minutes longer. Mixed amid the blood and tissue were tiny, recognizable body parts. Dr. Parker believes in transparency in his work. He understands that a fetus is a life. He does not believe it's a person. His question comes down to the moral responsibilities we have to each other. While pro-life protesters are protecting the rights of the fetus, who is protecting the rights of women? The woman who had come in to have that abortion at 15 weeks had 3 other children under the age of 4. She could not afford another child without compromising the care of the one she already had. Did coming to the clinic make her a terrible mother or a responsible one? I myself have not had an abortion. I always believed myself to be pro-choice. Then I got pregnant with my 3rd child, and at 7 weeks began spotting heavily. The thought of losing that pregnancy was devastating to me at that time. In my mind, this was already a baby. However, had I been a college sophomore with a 7-week pregnancy, I would have sought out an abortion. Where we draw the line shifts. Not just between those who are pro-life and pro-choice, but in each individual woman, depending on her current circumstances. Laws are black and white. The lives of women are 1,000 shades of gray. So can we solve the abortion debate without legislation? Let's begin with the principle that nobody wants to have an abortion, that it's a last resort. If we assume that the pro-life camp wants to reduce or eliminate procedures, and that the pro-choice camp wants women to be able to make decisions about their own reproductive health, perhaps the place to start is before the pregnancy, with contraception. In the United States, in 2015, there were 57 teenagers.